In 1982, it appeared on the hamburger patties of fast food. Today, it is appearing on the spinach leaves of vegetarians. This leads us to ask, can we survive E. coli 015787?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 519th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Civitavecchia who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford working the phones. And hello, Carol. Folks, in late 1992, 600 people were stricken with a violent intestinal disorder from eating jack-in-the-box hamburgers. The problem? A new variant of our old friend, the E. coli bacteria. Now, many of us, of course, are already too familiar with E. coli, as it was the bacteria that brought us the turistas. But this new variant of E. coli proved to be much more dangerous than our old friend, as it emits a deadly Shiga toxin that is capable of ruining our lives and ruining our livers and taking our lives. This new weaponized E. coli was named E. coli 015787. 0157 has since wreaked havoc in municipal water systems, apple cider, daycare centers, petting zoos, and the nation's salad bowl. In fact, since 1993, there have been 26 E. coli 015787 outbreaks traced to leafy green vegetables. This year, a single outbreak took the lives of three, sickened hundreds, and cost farmers a cool $100 million or so. 110,000 of us are now being stricken by the 0157 every year, and so we ask, can we survive E. coli 0157? Here to help us find some answers today, we have a couple of really good guests. One of them, to start with, is Professor James Marsden, Professor of Animal Science, Kansas State University. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you aboard. You're Regents Distinguished Professor of Animal Sciences, Kansas State University. I guess if beef is what's for dinner, James Marsden is one of the people who is making it possible. Jim, tell us a little bit about your research into the E. coli situation.
You know, Michael, when that outbreak you discussed occurred back in 1992 and 1993, I was actually in Washington, D.C. with the American Meat Institute Foundation. And I left there in 1994 and came to Kansas State University specifically to do research for controlling this pathogen in beef products.
Mm-hmm. And, so we're talking about the jack-in-the-box incident,
that's
right?
That's right, the jack-in-the-box outbreak of 1992-1993. And what we did was we focused on pasteurization technologies that could be applied in the beef industry.
Mm-hmm.
That would still allow for raw meat to be produced, but the pasteurization step applied upstream in the process at the carcass level. And what this has done, as it's been implemented in the industry over the years, is greatly reduced the incidence of E. coli 015787 in beef products, and that's supported by USDA testing that's way down over the past several years to a very low incidence now, and also a decrease in the amount of disease associated with beef products as well, which is also way down.
Mm-hmm.
as measured by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Got some success there to work with, right?
We do.
All right, good. Also with us today, Trevor Suslow, who is am I pronouncing that right, Trevor?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, good. Extension Research Specialist, University of California, Davis. And you, of course, are working on vegetables. So if vegetables are for dinner, I guess you have a lot in the making that possible for us. Tell us about, you've done a significant amount of research on E. coli and have published some papers toward that. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Yeah, a lot of my work focuses on several phases from the production side or the pre-harvest components all the way through post-harvest management and post-harvest handling through distribution and transportation, really trying to characterize, you know, the various hazards, assist the industry, you know, in that sort of analysis, and then do appropriate, hopefully, applied research to both characterize the risk and then come up with some, you know, interventions or, you know, control measures, mitigations, as it may be. You know, that's taken up an awful lot of my time over the last 6 years.
Well, I guess for good reason, too. Well, start with both of you. E. coli is a ubiquitous bacteria, been around forever. And yet, when we hear about E. coli in the press, we're often associated with E. coli 0157H7. So perhaps we can make a distinguish the two here. First, E. coli is a bacteria that's almost everywhere, correct?
That's correct. The generic bacteria E. coli, it really is ubiquitous. It's in or on every living thing, really, you can imagine. E. coli 0157H7 is not nearly so common. It's actually a fairly rare bacteria. It's carried in animals. It's not a pathogen in animals. It doesn't make animals sick. But, of course, it does make us very ill, potentially in humans. So that's why it's so important to control it.
Mm-hmm. Got an engineer in here to see if we can work on this. The phone system seems... All right, so we've got a little technical difficulty, but we'll just plug on. Where did E. coli 0157 come from? All of a sudden, 1982, we have this big problem, and where did it come from?
Well, I don't think anyone really knows for sure. You know, bacteria mutate, and the organism is actually very similar to another organism that called Shigella. That's a human pathogen. It's really more similar to Shigella than it is to generic E. coli. And the toxin that you mentioned, the Shiga-like toxin, that's how it got its name, is because it's so similar to the microorganism Shigella.
Trevor, that ring true to you?
Yeah, certainly does. One of the aspects of this and what people are trying to understand is how bacteria share genetic elements that allow them mm-hmm. to resist environmental stresses, resist the different types of stresses that in the past we may have assumed would really be limiting. And we know that they do this through a variety of mechanisms. And, you know, one of the other things that's so challenging is, you know, for a number of reasons, is that they also share some of the genetic elements for at least the potential to produce these particular toxins with not just other, you know, E. coli and Shigella, but some other members of the environmental microflora.
Mm-hmm. So bacteria are kind of like people, aren't they? They're sharing information about how to get by in the world.
Only much more quickly than people.
Yeah, much more quickly. And they respond much more quickly to things that we do, and we, you know, quite often likely to have selected for strains that are better adapted to, you know, live within the systems that we're more intensely managing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in looking into E. coli 0157H7, there seem to be two different strains of thought, or two different proposals as to why 0157 developed. And I'd like to put them out to you and have your speculation. First, of course, is the notion that feedlot cattle and the feeding of grain to ruminants creates an environment very favorable to 0157. Dr. Marsden, what do you think about that?
Well, the facts really don't support that at all. We first started seeing this bacteria in dairy cows, which most often are grass-fed. So really the origins of the organism were just opposite of what you just described.
So it came from grass?
We now see it, you know, across all cattle, dairy cattle, as well as the feedlot cattle. But I don't think there's any evidence that supports it has anything to do with feedlots.
Okay, when did we first start seeing it, by the way? When did
We first started seeing it in the 1980s. In the early 1980s, and really by the late 1980s, we started to recognize its importance as a pathogen and began recommending control measures and testing in the food industry. And then, of course, things changed dramatically in 1993 with the Jack in the Box outbreak. Then things moved into a very rapid pace.
Okay, Trevor, that bring about with what you've been seeing as well.
Yeah, certainly, you know, all of that is consistent with my understanding, and, you know, this is where, you know, maybe I'm speaking outside of my, you know, sort of scientific expertise per se, but, you know, we do try and follow research being done on the animal side to understand that as a reservoir for things like 015787, and it's kind of what the discussion has been, points out some of the difficulty, some of the challenges of taking scientific information and communicating that, you know, effectively, you know, to the public and through the media. And a lot of the things that we've been seeing and hearing over the last 8 weeks, you can put many of them in the, well, that has been shown to be a bit controversial. One study has it come out this way, you know, grain fed, you know, stimulates
right.
problem, and, you know, then the other side is that, well, there is really a non-issue. And the same thing with internalization and uptake through the roots of plants like lettuce and spinach. It's just getting all of that down into a very nice little understandable soundbite is often a challenge. And you have scientists that disagree with each other. So then what's the public supposed to do?
Okay. Well, we're supposed to ask questions and get answers. And we'll do that when we get back from this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Trevor Suslow and James Marsden and you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, E. coli 015787. Can we survive the bug? What do you think? Right back. Water users, you can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and get rid of calcium carbonate deposits. No, not by magic. By installing an Aquamax catalytic converter in your water line that will induce epitaxial nucleation. Listen.
Hello, I'm Karen Kuhn. My father promised me that if I installed an Aquamax, I could grow grass where I've never been able to grow grass. And it's the truth. Was bare and spotty and is now deep-rooted and healthy. It's wonderful. We use much less water, and the plants look absolutely beautiful.
You can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and eliminate calcium carbonate deposits just by installing an Aquamax on your water line. No chemicals, no filters. Explore the possibility. Go to metrofarm.com, click on the Aquamax Water Saver banner, and save. That's metrofarm.com. Well, it's pretty strange, don't you think? Here in the cleanest country in the world, 110,000 of us every year are contracting the E. coli 015787 bacteria and getting sick. So we're looking at the situation, trying to figure out why. Approximately 75% of us are contracting the bacteria from not cooking our meat enough, but now 25% of us are contracting it from vegetables. So what are we going to do to survive this? First thing we're going to try to do is understand what it is. And to do that, we're talking with Trevor Suslow, who's an extension research specialist at the University of California, Davis, and James Marsden, who's a professor of animal science at Kansas State University. We have one more interesting speculation as to where E. coli 015787 came from, and it's kind of so strange. I almost, am afraid to bring it up, but it was brought up by a scientist working for the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, and he suggests the possibility that it was a bacteria that was engineered in somebody's laboratory, a genetically engineered organism in which somebody took one of the ubiquitous E. coli bacteria and spliced it together with the Shigella bacteria and made the E. coli 015787, and somehow it escaped the laboratory, and here we are. What do you think about that wild and crazy notion, Professor Marsden?
Actually, that's the first time I really heard about that one. It sounds like wild speculation, actually.
Okay.
You know, one of the things about this organism that really even impacts the recent spinach outbreak is that it's often carried in wild animals.
Right, and we're going to get to that for sure.
Right.
We're going to get to that for sure. But let me ask Trevor, Trevor Suslow, what do you think about the possibility of it having been genetically engineered?
Well, I would agree that certainly falls in the category of... Wild. Pretty far stretch and speculation that I think you wouldn't have to go to that length to imagine how, you know, it could develop. As I said, you know, there are a lot of ways that genetic information is shared by microorganisms through, you know, viral transfer, through all sorts of ways.
That's what producer Carol Stafford says.
Yeah, and, you know, that's, you know, I guess people can formulate their own, you know, hypothesis, you know, as they will.
Well, thanks for shooting that one down. One more possibility is that it's always been here. Is there a possibility of that?
Yeah, I think though what you're missing is that bacteria, the generation time for bacteria is measured in minutes.
Uh-huh.
So you've got a situation where, you know, a generation time for humans is measured in, you know, decades.
Right.
And every 15 minutes or so, you've got a new generation of bacteria, and then there's all kinds of opportunities for genetic information to be changed through mutation or and like Trevor points out, different other ways as well. So you probably had a change in this microorganism that resulted in the ability to produce this shigellate toxin,
mm-hmm.
and it's unlikely that it was there for a long period of time before we started seeing some evidence of it in with respect to human disease.
Okay, so that...
Well, and I think the other thing to remember is that there are, of course, many other forms of pathogenic E. coli, and what may, you know, shift them over to something that we recognize as being far more aggressive, far more virulent is the, you know, the uptake of some of these new genetic traits, new virulence factors like the shigatoxin production. So there have been many forms that can invade, cause disease in humans, and they pick up a few more traits, and all of a sudden you have a much more serious problem at hand.
Mm-hmm. Okay, given that condition, is it possible that the industrialization of our agriculture has made them more predominant? I mean, you have something that is toxic, and you have an industrialization process whereby you pool things together. Meat products, of course, are pooled together and made into a big batch of hamburger, and spinach and lettuces are mixed together in big batches and put into bags. And could it be then that a little bit of this can go a long way just by virtue of this pooling process, Dr. Marsden?
Well, that might change the epidemiology of outbreaks and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't change the you know, the basic fact that this microorganism is present. If the
right.
food chain were, you know, totally different, you would still see cases. They may be more isolated and less likely to become outbreaks, but it really wouldn't change the basic fact.
Okay, right. Trevor?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that there is every reason to, you know, to more closely evaluate, you know, what role consolidation and, you know, the more current or more modern production and post-harvest handling practices, you know, have on contributing to, you know, the epidemiology, as was mentioned, the extent, the number, the multi-state nature of it, you know, and, you know, the variety and diversity of forms in which, you know, consumers would be exposed. You know, I think one thing that certainly is being looked at and, you know, will be looked at much more closely is some of these sporadic cases of, you know, the same type of strain as well as other subtypes of O157H7, that there's always a low level that's out there. It's just when it gets to the point where our public health system recognizes an unusual frequency or unusual clustering that it gets the attention that would cause it to fall into outbreak category.
And, you know, given the nature of the world these days, it seems like we're much more capable of recognizing outbreaks than possibly we ever were before, true?
Well, there's no question. We have much better monitoring of foodborne
right.
disease than we've ever had before.
We're paying very close attention. Well, let's go back to the E. coli. Where on earth does the O157 live?
Well, it lives in the gastrointestinal tract of the animal.
Of do we know which animal?
Well, it's been identified in various animals. and it's spread through fecal contamination, which could be naturally occurring in wild animals or through cross contamination in food animals. And that's really what makes it so very difficult to control, is that you have, you know, natural contamination that occurs in nature, and it's absorbed into the soil or on the tops of plants, or you get cross contamination in food animals, and it finds its way into the food chain.
Mm-hmm. So we hear, of course, cattle is where most of it lives, I guess, and then it makes its way through the food chain from cattle, or does it exist in a lot of other animals as well, naturally?
It does exist in other animals as well as cattle. There's some speculation that it may even be carried in some cases by insects. It's a naturally occurring microorganism.
So anything that comes into contact with fecal matter might well be a carrier, correct?
Yeah, and that's another thing that kind of is hard to envision. But we're not talking about, you know, gross contamination. We're talking about microscopic contamination that may be so limited that it's invisible.
Wow. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about E. coli 0157. We're asking the question: can we survive this microorganism? To do that, we of course are going to have to understand what it is, and where it comes from, and how it's vectored from one location to the next. And here to help us do that today, we have James Marsden, who's a professor of animal science at Kansas State University, and Trevor Suslow, who is an extension research specialist, University of California, Davis. We have a meat guy and we have a veggie guy, and we're talking E. coli. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, they are here, and they are there, and they are pretty much everywhere. They are E. coli, and the new variant, or relatively new variant of E. coli 0157H7, which is causing a lot of problems up and down our food chain, and we're trying to figure out what we're going to do to survive them, and the best place to start is to understand what they are and where they live and how they get from place to place. Before the break, we learned that E. coli 0157 lives in the intestinal tract of a lot of different animals, and it starts, I guess, with the fecal matter and in the contact with contaminated fecal matter, and away it goes from there. I have a question that popped into my mind. Do we have incidents of E. coli 0157H7 outbreaks in developing nations of the world? Dr. Suslow, let's start with you.
As far as I'm aware, you know, there are forms of the Shiga toxin producing E. coli that, you know, really can be found globally.
Mm-hmm.
It's not restricted to the 0157H7 type. That does also occur in other places outside the U.S. What I think my understanding from the folks at this Center for Disease Control and within the FDA is that we tend to see a bit more cases in, you know, the U.S. and Europe than in other areas, and they tend to have some of the other types of pathogens that are still found here or prevalent here, but maybe not on those associated with the same types of food.
Huh, interesting. Dr. Marsden, what about China? I mean, China still uses night soil in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. Well, China has a lot of problems with foodborne disease. This is not a reportable disease in China, so I think it's a little bit off their radar screen.
Oh, really? So then we don't know if they have it, if they do have it.
Well, they in all likelihood have some form of virotoxigenic E. coli that mm-hmm. you know, causes sporadic diseases. That they have their problems in China with foodborne disease are really on a different order of magnitude than what we have in the United States. They're still, in some ways, a developing country and still developing appropriate controls with respect to food safety.
Good. Well, you know, a lot of the problems that we've heard about with respect to out here in California and the salad bowl of the world, the Salinas Valley here, you know, we're looking at the problem of the possibility of wild pigs breaking through fences and rooting around in spinach fields. And yet, when one talks with pathologists from various universities, they also bring up the fact that, well, this stuff can live in the intestines of deer and other wild animals as well. So is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yes, it is.
So if we care to really address this issue, then we're going to have to look at not just wild pigs. Trevor?
Oh, absolutely. You can't. You have to take a much more comprehensive approach, you know, to both characterizing and understanding who can vector it, or, you know, who can move it around, who can harbor it, you know, either long-term or in a transient manner, you know, mm-hmm. just sort of it passes through, you know, and try and start working at reducing the, you know, the sources and the potential for cross-contamination.
Wow.
Pretty much everything that moves, crawls, you know, has at least the
potential
to, yeah, to move it over from a place to, mm-hmm. you know, where fresh produce is being
could be a common fly, but it gets right down to it.
Certainly, they have been shown to be carriers.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about how the 0157 contaminates our food supply. Let's start with meat, because that's where we've had most of our experience. Dr. Marston, that's been where you've done a lot of your work. How does our meat products become contaminated with 0157H7?
Okay, we can talk about meat, and a lot of what I say applies to other food products
right.
as well. But what happens is we get this microscopic contamination, which originates in fecal matter. But I don't want to imply that you have gross fecal contamination, because that's really not what's happening. You have microscopic contamination that occurs and during the slaughter process. For animals, and then that is carried into trimmings and so on that eventually find their way into ground beef.
So
that's
when we're talking about microscopic, quite literally, you can see these bacteria, but only if you're looking through a very powerful microscope, right?
Oh, certainly. You cannot see them with the naked eye. Of course not.
Okay.
And that's why it's so important that we have a kill step somewhere in the process. A step that systematically eliminates these bacteria, much the way that they're eliminated in milk through pasteurization.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we focused on trying to stop that, stop the organism at the carcass level through a thermal pasteurization or heat pasteurization step.
Mm-hmm. So we're probably talking irradiation then, huh?
Oh, no, we're just talking about steam or hot water.
Oh, really?
The organism's not that difficult to kill with the heat. So,
then you could steam clean a carcass, and away you go.
Those two things that you just mentioned are exactly what we do. We steam clean, much the same way you'd steam clean upholstery,
mm-hmm.
and we also systematically steam or apply hot water to that carcass at temperatures that kill the bacteria on the carcass.
Wow,
that's why there's been such a decrease in incidence in meat, and a corresponding decrease in disease associated with meat.
Well, that's great news, but unfortunately, when we look at, like, lettuce, we're not going to get that kind of good news, are we, Trevor Suslow?
No, unfortunately not. It certainly would apply to some of the other types of fresh fruits and vegetables that are handled. They also can tolerate steam treatment, if you will, and that's used on many of the melons that end up mm-hmm. being part of the fresh cut. But, you know, lettuce, leafy greens, and that's how you want to eat them. It's a pretty harsh treatment.
Well, let me ask you this. It's kind of obvious how meat products could be contaminated in the slaughter process. But what about vegetables? I mean, and this, of course, is the great puzzle in the Salinas Valley, where the nation grows its vegetables. So how on earth do plants in the field get contaminated with E. coli 0157?
Well, I think, you know, there are unfortunately so many different potential routes. It's actually been a bit of a barrier to figure out in any of the outbreaks that are recognized exactly which one or which several may have happened, you know, in any particular time frame. I think it's important, at least from my perspective, to point out that contamination to the level, you know, that we would recognize as being responsible for, you know, the kind of illness
for an outbreak
that we see is, you know, truly the exception and not the rule. Obviously, it happens, and obviously, it seems to be happening on, you know, a bit of a recurring basis.
Well, it's happened 26 times since 1993.
Well, you know, I'll just say it depends on how you want to count it. And there's no point in debating that it happens and has happened frequently. Some of the what's included, what's excluded, it doesn't all come back to a particular region, although many of them have. It's around.
Okay, can we pick that up when we get back? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about E. coli 015787, and can we survive it? And, of course, the best way to survive something is to understand it. And here to help us understand it, we have James Marsden, professor of animal science, Kansas State, and also Trevor Suslow, extension research specialist, UC Davis. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Folks, there's about 110,000 of us here in the developed world that are contracting the E. coli 015787 bacteria every year and getting really sick because of it. And we're looking at what we can possibly do to survive this bacteria. And the best thing to do to survive anything is to understand it. And we're working with a couple of great people here who are helping us do that. Jim Marsden from Kansas State and Trevor Suslow from UC Davis. We're talking a little bit about the transmission of E. coli 0157 within the vegetable fields, and we're wondering just about how that happens. It's kind of obvious how it happens in the slaughtering of meat, but in the vegetable fields, we're having a little bit of trouble. Trevor Suslow, we've got all kinds of different ways that this can be transmitted. Poor handling, worker sanitation, animal vectors of one kind or another, water, wind. What on earth can we do about that? Something that has so many ways of happening.
Yeah, I wish there was a great, simple, insightful answer. And, you know, a lot of it, I think, revolves around, you know, really characterizing the potential hazards in and around each specific production location. You know, there are certainly general principles to follow, but it really comes down to, you know, a detailed analysis and detailed knowledge of specific risks at the farm. For each location, and that certainly has happened and is increasingly happening, but obviously we're not 100% there yet.
Well, the USDA has been pointing its fingers at the Salinas Valley and saying that there is something systemically wrong in the Salinas Valley. What are they talking about?
Well, I think what you're referring to is the, you know, the FDA and the California Department of Health Services,
right.
You know, and others, not the USDA, that's not critical, but I mean, it's really, you know, certainly based on what we've been mentioning, that there is a recurring pattern that seems to be associated with production during a particular time of year, sort of late summer, early fall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of that, you know, is certainly a function of the great volumes of production,
right,
in those lettuce, you know, and leafy green category that are all coming from that region.
Yeah, the nation's salad bowl, right?
Absolutely. You know, some 70% of the nation's leafy greens are coming from that region during that time of the year. So that certainly is a component. There would, you know, appear, although we don't have it fully characterized or understood yet, you know, that there are maybe environmental or microenvironmental factors that, you know, cause that to have that sort of recurring pattern,
mm-hmm.
As well as,
well, it could be the mating patterns of skunks or something, and you just have, how would you know?
Well, I think more concerted effort at really evaluating the sources and, you know, the nature and frequency at which they move in and around the production fields. Again, I think there doesn't seem to be a single unifying factor in the different outbreaks that have occurred.
Which is the problem, right?
Which is certainly part of the problem, but, you know, part of that, you know, is a function of at what point, you know, can you get back to the farm? You know, how soon after the event? What factors may still be present? You know, which ones or which locations, since they, you know, can come from potentially multiple locations,
right,
within a single production date, even, you know, it makes it very hard to narrow down. So,
you are.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the potential, you know, things that can contribute, you know, it may be, as, you know, was pointed out earlier, a very, very small amount of microscopic contamination, and then other events allow for the multiplication or amplification of that.
So a little bit can get in, and then you can put it in a big pot, and then it can incubate and take off like that. Then,
well, again, and that, none of that's been proven yet, but certainly, right, the circumstances and the, you know, ability of E. coli 15787 to multiply on things like spinach is
at
the right temperature is really amazing.
What did Dr. Marsden say? Every 15 minutes?
That's a little bit faster, but I mean, certainly, you know, their multiplication time would be in the 15-20 minute range under perfect,
wow,
conditions. What we've characterized is they double their number about every hour on damaged spinach. On they can grow on the nutrients available on fresh spinach, you know, at warm temperatures about once every hour.
Whew, okay. Well, Dr. Marsden has figured out how to steam clean carcasses to reduce significantly the amount of contamination, but what can we do for spinach and lettuce?
Well, a lot of it, what we can do, really needs to focus on prevention of contamination. Obviously, we've already discussed, you know, the many challenges to doing that, but everything that can be done
must be done.
You know, must be done, really. And then part of that is there certainly are gains from the use of just washing.
Right.
It's not.
Well, I'd like to get to that when we get back from this break.
That's fine.
And I'd like to ask you both what we consumers can do to protect ourselves from E. coli 015787. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're talking about the new bug in town, E. coli 015787, and what you and I can do to survive it. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. If you don't get a chance to call up today, you can always log your comments by going to the forum page at metroforum.com and asking questions, making comments there. Do stay tuned, right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, we're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about E. coli 015787. We have a few minutes left, and we're going to ask the most important question of all, I guess, is what you and I as consumers can do to survive the E. coli 0157. And we have a couple of great people to ask. James Marsden, who's a professor of animal science, Kansas State University, one of the people who are really responsible for us being able to eat steak on one side of the country when that steak was produced on the other side of the country. Also, Trevor Suslow, who's the plant guy at the Extension Research of the University of California, and he's one of the people who helps us eat our veggies, even though we don't live where the veggies are grown. And so what a great opportunity to get some expertise here. So let's start with Professor Marsden. What on earth can we consumers do to protect ourselves when eating meat? Professor Marsden?
Well, there's the responsibility really goes clear across the food chain, all the way from production.
Amen to that.
Of food, whether it's animal food or whether it's plant food. A lot can be done in manufacturing plants, just like pasteurizing milk,
mm-hmm.
to reduce the risk that harmful bacteria will be present on foods.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, food has to be properly distributed with respect to temperature and so on. And then consumers can further reduce the risk by following safe handling practices in the kitchen, which includes washing of fruits and vegetables and care and handling meat, and then, of course, cooking meat to appropriate temperatures. If all those things are followed, you know, from the farm to the table, this foodborne illness that we talk about really wouldn't happen anymore. So it is a shared responsibility.
Or at least it wouldn't happen to the extent that it's happening.
It would certainly be greatly reduced, of course.
Okay, Trevor Suslow, what about vegetables? What can we do, what can we consumers do to protect ourselves?
Well, again, a lot of the same principles and recommendations apply. Certainly washing any
mm-hmm.
raw fruits and vegetables.
Does washing help?
Washing does help. Again, it's not foolproof, but washing under running tap water in an area that, you know, you've taken the responsibility to mm-hmm. thoroughly clean is, you know, I think what is a reasonable thing for consumers to do. Those things that can tolerate sort of mechanical action with a good, you know, fruit and vegetable brush and can be brushed, that helps as well. I mean, what we don't recommend is they start, you know, trying to treat things with, you know, chlorine and delete solutions, and certainly not to use, you know, soaps to clean.
Thus creating another problem entirely, right?
Exactly, yes.
What about in making the purchase? What about when we buy something? Is there something we can watch for? Trevor?
Well, I think, you know, it's the reasonable things that you would do is you know, try and avoid anything that is you know, badly damaged and can't be trimmed away. Things that are, you know, showing signs of spoilage or decay. Again, that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with
E. coli
157X7, but, you know, they're it's a reasonable precaution, you know, to take. I mean, again, as been said, it's highly unlikely that there would be anything that, you know, can be visually seen that would cause you to, you know, to suspect that there was a problem.
Well, okay, what about it out there? Can we survive E. coli 0157H7? We invite you to post your thoughts on the forum page at metrofarm.com. And we especially want to say thanks to Jim Marston from Kansas State University and Trevor Suslow from UC Davis for joining us today. And we want to thank all of you for tuning in. We hope to see you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.